This is Peter Aylward on the Space Show, and we're joined by a very special guest, Apollo astronaut Fred Hayes. Fred, welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here. Talking a little long distance.
That's correct, yeah. So, Fred, we're talking now in just coming up to the 45th anniversary of your space flight, Apollo 13. 45 years later, how does it all feel for you? Recollections on the mission, what happened during the mission, and what happened subsequent to the mission?
Well, you know, the mission was one event in my life, and of course it was a rather dramatic event, so I remember most of the, major parts, like the launch, entries, the explosion. So, you know, and there's segments of the mission like that that are just today as real as they were back then.
Sure.
Of course, I've had occasion over the years to talk about it a lot, many different events of all sorts.
Sure. Well, look, Fred, let's talk about the mission a little bit later on, because as you rightly point out, it's just one part of your amazing life. So perhaps we could rewind back to, well, maybe not the very start, but very early on in your life. I believe you were born in Biloxi, Mississippi, and grew up around there.
Yes, South Mississippi, a very small town, about 14,000 people at the time. It was a mixed town of fishing, waterfront. It was a very small tourist business. At the time, though, it was one of the largest suppliers of oysters and shrimp for the United States. They had a number of shrimp factories, they called them, probably about six of them that were active at that point in time. And, of course, as a boy, I spent a lot of time on the waterfront, a lot of swimming, a lot of fishing, that sort of thing through my life while there through actually high school and then 2 years of junior college.
And I believe you still have a passion for fishing today, is that right?
I do, yes. I have. We have a second home in Mississippi at a little town called Goche. The French pronunciation would be Goche, I guess. But it's a small town today, probably about 10,000 population, and we have a home on a bayou that's off the Pascoola River that's complete with alligators. But within a very short distance, I can fish freshwater in the bayou, or drive about 2.5 miles in my boat, and I'm in the Gulf of Mexico, saltwater.
Wow. So is that like Cajun country down there? Is there the Cajun culture, the French American sort of mixture of cultures and music?
No, not Biloxi. That's Louisiana. If you had the primary you look at from beyond the Gulf Coast area would be Slovakian. There's a large Slovakian population that is down at the east end of the town, settled in there, and they were mostly tied with the fishing industry. I don't know, the rest of the people there are probably from all over, and have since, of course, come in from all over. But that's probably, no, I wouldn't call it Cajun country.
So, look, I've read a note here back in your early days when you were young. You actually had a bit of an apprehension of flying. Now, obviously, you've turned out to be an accomplished pilot. You must have overcome that apprehension.
I didn't have apprehension. It was just I never had any interest.
Okay.
I had never, never had been even inside of an airplane sitting on the ground when I went off to flight training. Never flown in anything, airliner or anything. And I guess the apprehension was when I got into flight training and pre-flight, quite a number of my classmates had flown and were talking about their flight experiences in light airplanes. And so I was a little worried about they knew a lot more than I knew about the subject and how I was going to fare when I got into really the flying part.
And you came into that through the Naval Aviation Cadet Program, is that correct?
That's correct. It was the only program. I had finished high school at 16 years old, and I went through 2 years of junior college. So at 18, with 2 years of college during the Korean War, that was the only service I could get into that would lead to a commission, which was really my primary goal, not the wings and flying, but that was the only program that would lead to the commission. So that's how I jumped in, and obviously I took to the flying a lot when I got into it.
So we're talking early 50s here, Fred. 52.
Right, this is 1952. Right. That's when I went in.
Fantastic. And then from that you graduated and got your wings, and you were flying with the U.S. Marine Corps, is that correct?
That's correct. I had a choice. I actually was a Navy cadet, as everybody was in that program. Went in without a commission. And I really was planning on staying Navy because my father was Navy. He was an emergency Marine, and he... for 12 years, and then he joined the Navy during World War II and was in the Navy then. So, but I got to advanced training where they make the assignments at Advanced Training Command, and I went into the office where they assign you, and they were going to put me in the seaplanes. So when they were going to put me in the seaplanes, I decided I'd become a Marine cadet, which simply meant primarily changing your belt, the belt you wore on your cadet uniform. Because I knew in Marines I'd either end up with a TAC or a fighter-type aircraft.
Right, so primarily you weren't as interested in the heavy, slow, larger aircraft. You wanted to get the fast jets, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Fantastic, okay. And then from there you were there for quite a while, and I think you then did a Bachelor of Science, is that correct? During that time? A Bachelor of Science, is that correct?
Well, no. What happened was I went into the Marine Corps, and I was served in two squadrons, BMF 533, which had Banshee, McDonnell Douglas aircraft, and the second squadron, BMF 114, had Cougars, Swept-Wing Grumman aircraft. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, by that time I had figured out, thought at least, I wanted to become a test pilot. And the road to be a test pilot required you to have an engineering degree. So I went back to school then on the GI Bill at the University of Oklahoma. And while there, I continued flying high-performance aircraft in the Oklahoma Air National Guard while I was in college for 3 years to get my engineering degree. And with that, I joined NASA. It was an opening at Lewis Research Center at in Cleveland, Ohio, which is now Glenn Research Center, named after John Glenn.
Right.
And in fact, my trail then through NASA was, and it just had become NASA, in fact, at that time in 1959. It became NASA in 58. I basically followed in Neil Armstrong's footsteps. Neil was 2.5 years ahead of me. He started at Lewis in Cleveland. Then he had transferred to NASA Flight Research Center at Edwards Air Force Base in California, which now is named after Neil. It's Armstrong Flight Research Center. And so I did the same thing. After 3.5 years at Lewis, I transferred to Edwards and then followed Neil into the astronaut program.
When did you meet Neil? Did you get to know him back in those days, or was it only after?
Oh, yes, I knew him when I would go out to Edwards from Lewis. So I knew him when he was still, before he joined the astronaut program, when he was flying overlapped, and he was flying the X-15
right. At
that time.
Okay. During that time, was that when you were involved in the lifting body program? I believe you flew some lifting bodies?
No, I really was slated to fly in the powered flight portion of it, what we call the heavyweight vehicles, that were carried up by the B-52 and launched much like the X-15. The only flights I got, I and Joe Engel, they gave us a chance to fly on tow behind a very fast vehicle across the lake bed, where we'd get up to several hundred feet with this lightweight version and just feel out the control system and do a landing off of a long rope tow.
Oh.
No, I never actually flew it airborne and made a landing after I was in free flight.
Right. So was that the RD-4 aircraft that you're talking about there? Or?
Oh, it was the M2F1.
Okay.
Right. The first heavyweight was the M2F2, and after it crashed, which became the opening scene of the $6 Million Man TV show,
yes,
It was retrofitted through the M2F3 with a where they added another vertical tail in the center to give it a little better directional stability.
Right.
But no, I was and I did a lot of preliminary work to the lifting body program, flying a variable stability. Looking at different models, the handling characteristics of models that had been wind tunnel tested at Ames and at Langley, NASA Langley, those two centers. And from that, out of those multiple, I'm talking like 30 or 40 models, the ones that were chosen to eventually build were the M2, F2, and the HL-10 aircraft. And so that I was involved in that preliminary work. And then with a variable stability T-33, specially modified where this, rather than tip tanks, they modified it where it had speed brakes out at the ends of each wing that could flare open so it could emulate the drag of a lifting body. And through the computers, it could make it the handling quality similar to what it would be for the various the types of lifting bodies we chose eventually to build and fly.
So I
had to adapt the program to sort of the preliminary before we got to flying the actual lifting bodies.
So the objective of those lifting body program, was that for return from space type vehicles, or what was the sort of the core objective of that program?
Well, I'm not sure overall, but at least the idea I had and others that were flying at the time, we thought it would be the type of vehicle that could survive a Martian reentry, which was going to be up around 60,000, 70,000 foot a second, whereas lunar entries are about 36,000
wow.
second. So you really could probably not rig a machine to survive that heating with wings.
Right.
The lifting body. In fact, the M2, F2, F1 and F2 were virtually, if you looked at the shape, it was almost like you took an ICBM nose cone and sliced it through, and so we knew it was a good shape. And of course, they did a lot of wind tunnel and arc jet tests, so it was good for to handle that kind of a heating regime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it was looked at the time. Of course, as they've flown lifting bodies, the Air Force has one, as you know, that's gone up and stayed over a year, I think, and recovered a couple of times. And one of the early proposals for the shuttle, the one Lockheed proposed. And their submittal was a lifting body,
right.
rather than a vehicle. Of course, Rockwell was chosen, which has the Delta Wing space shuttle. But so it was looked at for other things as well.
Sure. And of course, if we fast forward 20 years, you were then involved with the approach and landing test for the actual space shuttle prior to its getting sent into space. Tell me a little bit about that program and how it related to your early experience with the lifting body.
Okay, well, I'll call it from my standpoint, looking at my overall participation in the early development was the, call it the crowning event of my career, really, because I left the astronaut office in 1972 and joined Aaron Cohen, who was heading the Orbiter Project Office. Aaron later became Senator Director of Johnson Space Center, but at the time he was the Director of the Development for the Orbiter component of the Space Shuttle system, which, as you know, is the complex part. The other parts are that sort of big gas tank that has some stuff in it, and two solid rockets, you know, that hung on the sides. So anyway, I was involved in the program office for almost 4 years. I led an ops team through all of the design reviews, up through critical design review on Enterprise, and through preliminary design review on Columbia, first orbital bird, and sat on an engineering change board as a member, a voting member, and was active in a program office sense at all of reviews at the various contractors throughout that period. And then I went back to the astronaut office and was fortunate enough to be named commander of Crew 1, where we only had two crews named to fly that approach and landing test program that we flew in 1977. One crew, the crew I had was with Gordon Fullerton, and the other crew was Joe Engel and Dick Truly. Dick, as you know, later became administrator of NASA later in his career.
Right.
So we were the only two crews that really got to fly Enterprise. We flew an 8-flight test program, and I got the Gordo and I got to fly 5 of the 8 flights we flew in that program. It was a very successful program for a test program. I think we had one problem on flight. Joe and Dick's first flight, I think, they had a leak in the hydrazine that feeds the APU systems, and it did, fortunately, only in the F compartment, only burned through a few wires that weren't that essential. And, of course, they made a normal landing. It ended well. That was about the only problem we had, and through that program, it was a very successful test program for that complex piece of machinery.
Sure. I mean, the Space Shuttle has been an amazing program, but has been criticized in many areas for its, in the early stages of its over-optimistic flight rates and return on investments and those types of things. Were you kind of aware, was the office kind of aware that, look, a lot of these promises to Congress were sort of a little bit overblown, and let's just keep going?
Yes, I had no idea of the, the early Mathematica study, I guess, had like 60 flights a year. And I think when it settled down, they still were thinking 24 flights a year. So, but no, I had no idea of the marketing, if you will, and how many customers there really were to fly what number of flights, practically speaking, you know, and what the early on, of course, we had no idea what the turnaround requirements would be. There were several faults in the what happened in the program. We ran into weight problems early, number one, and we cut like 25% out of the wing area. We blunted the crew cabin. We blunted the Ohms pods. So it made it a worse glider. It seriously damaged decreased the lift to drag ratio, which is a measure of what a glider, good glider is or not.
Sure.
And as a result, we exceeded the metallics capability. The first shuttle in the proposals were for a metallic shuttle. There was no tile.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was going to be mostly all titanium. In Canel X, like the X-15, and a material called Columbian. And so it was going to be an all-metal vehicle. And when we when the L of a D lift-to-drag went down, it became a worse glider. Of course, it came in a little steeper, and heating rates went up to exceed the metal capability. So we're kind of saved by having the tile material, which I think had been developed in research and development by Lockheed, that could fill the gap and provide a system that could sustain the entry heating that it ultimately had to deal with. We also had funding problems early on in shuttle. I know in the orbiter office, we got about half the money of the program plan the first 3 years.
Sounds like a familiar problem.
What's that?
Sounds like, yes, a familiar problem.
It is, and we had to do some... I'll call it extraordinary things with requirements or taking content out of the program to try to make ends meet and still hold schedule. For instance, the Challenger, the shuttle that later, a tragedy coming off the launch pad on launch that blew up, that was never supposed to be a flight vehicle. That was our structural test article that we took to about 80% loads only, and did away with fatigue test. It was also supposed to be fatigue test article. That way we preserved the hull that we could turn into a flight vehicle. We did away with a lot of testing planned. We did only thermal test, vacuum thermal test we did was one payload bay door and one Ohms pod. We did, that's it. We said, we'll get the rest of the data on orbit. Really, to me, was... pushing and taking risk. The only vibroacoustic we did was the F section of the orbiter. We did no crew cabin vibroacoustic. And you have to appreciate the vibroacoustic environment for shuttle was much worse than Apollo. On Apollo, we were way up on top, well away from the engines.
Sure.
The orbiter rode right with the engines, and particularly the solids right beside it. So we had to actually beef up the vibroacoustic facility at Johnson Space Center to do the test to increase the decibels for the vibroacoustic testing on that F thrust structure because it's much higher than Apollo.
Of course.
So those kind of things were done to try to take it out of the program, to try to save money. And another Enterprise, originally we had a second Enterprise. We had another vehicle to do the test program. And we deleted it early on.
Right.
So we had no backup vehicle, which normally you want in a test program because you can't expect problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no backup for Enterprise.
Sure. So you never flew the space shuttle. You left the program before it actually got into space in 81. Can you tell me why that was, Fred?
I would have stayed had we kept the mission. Jack Lausman and I were scheduled to fly the mission, which was to rescue Skylab. We were going to go up, and Jack actually would remotely fly a vehicle we were going to carry in the payload bay after we'd rendezvoused and set off a little ways. He was going to fly this vehicle over and dock it with at one end of Skylab. And then people on the ground would take over and orient Skylab the right direction and actually fire the propulsion system on this little flyover vehicle, which would either boost Skylab higher or more gracefully deorbit it, which, as you know, it wasn't quite as graceful, and I think components of it fell in Australia, in fact.
That's right. Thank you for that. We appreciate that.
Yeah, right. And that mission went away. So then the mission was primarily going to be one of the earlier tests of testing of the RMS arm, Canadian arm, and to do collect thermal data. Sitting in orbit and sitting in various attitudes for certain durations of time and collecting thermocouple data. So the mission just wasn't, call it, as exciting as I had hoped. And I had the opportunity, because I always wanted to get into program management. That's why I went to the Orbiter Project Office to get a little on-the-job training. And an opening at Grumman was offered to become vice president of space programs at Grumman Corporation in New York. So I decided not to pass up that opportunity and start my next career path.
Wonderful. Of course, Grumman was the manufacturer of the Apollo Lunar Module.
That's correct. Grumman, and that was a familiar territory for me because I had spent lots of months at Grumman during that phase in Apollo testing lunar modules, so I knew pretty much most of the program management people at Grumman.